Syracuse University GradCast. My name is Dan Olson Bang. I'm the Director of Professional and Career Development. I am very pleased today to be joined by Dr. Katina Rogers. She is the co-director of the Futures Initiative, an incubator that advances equity and innovation in higher education through student-centered teaching and learning, as well as promoting reinvestment in higher education as a public good. She also serves as co-director of the CUNY Humanities Alliance, director of programs and administration of Haystack, and as an adjunct faculty member in the CUNY Grad Center's master's program in digital humanities. She has a PhD from UC Boulder in comparative lit. Katina's visit is the first of a series of mini residencies in the Central New York Humanities Corridor Working Group that focuses on career exploration for humanities PhDs. And so I'm really excited about this initiative and about Katina's, I guess it's a virtual visit, but it's a visit nonetheless. And to announce and to share with you the talk that she's going to give, which is called Scholarship for the Public Good, Expanding Definitions of Academic Success, which takes place on Thursday, March 11th at 3. And there will also be a coffee hour with Katina on Friday, March 12th. That's from 1 to 2:30. So stay tuned. There'll be more information on that. So Katina, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Likewise. Do you mind starting off by sharing a little bit about the work you do at CUNY and at large and how you got here?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So as you mentioned in the bio, I am co-director of a program called the Futures Initiative at CUNY Graduate Center. One of the things that is unique about CUNY is its scope and reach within New York City. So the Graduate Center is a relatively small institution within CUNY, but CUNY itself has 24 campuses with almost 500,000 students, about half of them seeking degrees and the other half doing continuing ed. And that system includes community colleges, senior colleges, doctoral education, and of course, faculty members of all kinds and staff members as well. So what we think about at the Futures Initiative is what are all of the systems and structures that knit those institutions together, and what are the points of connection across community colleges, senior colleges, graduate education, because people tend to have so much going on within their particular spheres. It can be difficult sometimes to make those connections across spaces that might exist on separate campuses or across different disciplines. But they're really deeply linked. So one of the things that we've been trying to do is find ways to knit them together more deeply and to create spaces where people can be learning from one another. So we do this through relatively small programs that we then use as models for things that could be potentially scaled up or applied in different contexts. One example is the CUNY Humanities Alliance program, which has become a significant part of our programming. We're in the second phase of a grant from the Mellon Foundation. The purpose of the grant is to connect graduate education and community college teaching. And that link in particular is something that, at least at the time that the grant first began in 2016, there were really not very many examples of graduate programs that were thoughtfully and systematically preparing doctoral students for possible careers in community college contexts. And yet over half of students who are enrolled in post-secondary education right now are in community colleges. And so the program aims to find ways to embed doctoral students in those community college contexts and to have some cross-pollination across the two systems. We have other programs that focus on undergraduate students and on faculty members. That's one example of the kind of work that we do. You also asked how I got here.
Yes, I did.
I can tell you a little bit about that as well. I've been at the Graduate Center now for almost 7 years. And before that, my path felt pretty winding. And it's really only been you know, in the last few years and looking retrospectively, that I'm able to see a clear through line. When I was moving through each step, I really didn't know what the future was going to hold. And I think that that's true probably for a lot of people who pursue careers that are intellectual in nature, but not necessarily on the faculty track.
I'm sorry, but is that something that you were interested in from the start, the non-academic angle, or is that something that sort of grew on you over time or happened out of necessity, as sometimes is the case?
Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. It was at least somewhat out of necessity. I ended up moving to New York City with my partner while I was still finishing my degree and needed a job. I couldn't be teaching at CU Boulder anymore as I had been in the years prior. And so that move ended up shifting my path and opening a lot of doors that I hadn't foreseen previously. But I also, I was not committed to the idea of becoming a faculty member. I found teaching to be both really rewarding, but also really draining in a way that I was not sure would be sustainable for myself.
I know how that is.
And I think part of that too was, you know, going into teaching without a whole lot of training, which a lot of grad students, you know, end up doing, it getting sort of thrown into the pool and learning how to swim. I think that's changing, and there's more pedagogical training for a lot of grad students now than there was when I was getting started. But I think I had always had a sense that I was open to other possibilities, but I didn't know what those possibilities were.
Pretty common conundrum.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing, is that the faculty path is so well scripted at this point that I think that that is one of the reasons why it remains such a strong default, because, you know, when you're looking at other possibilities, there's much more openness. And my sense is that that has created a lot more agency for me in the directions my path has taken. But it's also really scary because
you don't know,
and there's not one category of positions that's necessarily going to be a fit. They're pretty idiosyncratic roles.
Especially when you know with such great specificity, you know, when I meet with a student who wants to be on the academic track, they know the overall stuff. They're not looking for, okay, so how does this work? What kind of job title should I be looking for? They're thinking about how to maximize their chances about something where they know the milestones, they know the name of it, they know what would be rewarded, and mm-hmm. you know what makes them a viable candidate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's every other job in the world. Who right. knows how many of those there are?
Yeah, completely. So I was like so many other people, I didn't know what that would look like. I ended up actually registering with a temp agency when I got to New York. And I mentioned that because I think that sometimes that was not something that I thought was going to lead anywhere, but sometimes those first steps end up being more significant later on than they seem at the time. I was really just trying to make the best decision that I could at each particular crossroads. But I ended up temping in a couple of foundations and nonprofits around New York City. And that was great. I mean, it gave me a chance to really quickly see inside the workings of grant-making organizations from the other side, you know, not from someone who's seeking funds, but how it actually looks when the program officers are evaluating grant proposals, how they go about making connections with possible people and projects. And I found it really interesting. And it also made me realize that as a graduate student, I just did not know much at all about the vast apparatus that supports higher education and that makes research and teaching possible, but that doesn't happen within universities. And I really liked the work. So that eventually became a full-time job. I was working at the Sloan Foundation, which focuses more on science and technology research, and eventually wanted to shift back more in the direction of the humanities, and was able to find a postdoctoral position with the University of Virginia in the Scholars Lab, working with Bethany Novisky and Abby Smith Rumsey on the tail end of it. They're such good people.
I've had
such great luck in the people that I've been able to work with. And those mentorships have really been significant too. I mean, the position at UVA was an 18-month postdoc, and that could be not a great position. You know, 18 months is not very long. You're just starting and you need to be looking for another job again. But what was really valuable to me about that position was that Bethany and Abby were really conscientious in making sure that I was doing work that I could carry with me, you know, that I would have something to point to when I finished, that I was meeting people along the way, that they were giving me space and time for professional development. So it ended up being really formative and a good chance for me to sort of shift back into an area where I felt like I had more, more content knowledge. I mean, it wasn't in my dissertation area, but at least in the humanities. From there, I worked at the Modern Language Association with Kathleen Fitzpatrick, again, just wonderful people. And that eventually led me to CUNY, where I work with Kathy Davidson and a team of graduate fellows and postdoctoral students. So it's really, I mean, when I tell the story now, it feels like there is some cohesion to it, but I really had no idea as I was moving through it where I would land.
You see themes in retrospect. I love the idea of temp agency as career exploration. I did the same thing, actually. I moved to New York and I used to go into the temp agency buildings, go from agency to agency. If they wouldn't take me, I'd just say, I'm here now. If, you know, there's no time for an appointment, but I'm here. And I did a lot of work through them and I learned a lot from that. Mm-hmm. That's something that Madison Avenue really affords for one, I think. And that's really great. I was struck by the book that will be part of the structure of your talk. It's called Putting the Humanities PhD to Work, Thriving in and Beyond the Academy, by the concept that, as you put it, public support requires public scholarship and the sense that the Academy needs to incentivize this kind of public scholarship in order to create momentum, in order to encourage scholars to do it and to create a, as you call it, a virtuous cycle. Where do you see that happening right now?
Yeah, this is something that's really important to me, especially being at a public institution that is constantly facing a budget crisis. I think that legibility in public context of our scholarship is really important. I have so many great examples fresh in mind. We hosted a conference last week called Graduate Education at Work in the World. And many of the people who gathered there, it was graduate students, faculty, staff from a number of different institutions. And I loved the examples that they were pointing to. So one was the University of Michigan, who their history department has been collaborating with places like the Holocaust Memorial Museum to create lab classroom environments where the students who are a part of this class at UMichigan are working on a necessary project for the partner organization, in this case, the Holocaust Museum, developing content, doing research, things that will become a part of their collection and their public-facing work. And I think that, you know, what I heard in those examples is that the partnership was, number one, incredibly meaningful for students because they saw so much immediate value in the work that they were doing. And I think that that creates a sense of urgency and excitement around the research and around the ways that it's being articulated, because you know that other people are going to be seeing it. It served a need for the museum itself. I mean, they didn't have anybody to do this particular work. And while there were challenges in having it go through a body of student work through a class, I think that from what I heard from the presenters, the end result was really great. So that's one example. University of Iowa's Obermann Center, they have a program called Humanities for the Public Good that is terrific. They have been a leader in this for a long time. University of Virginia's Praxis Program, the Scholars Lab, they've been doing, I would say, work that tends to be slightly more on the scholarly side of things than entirely public facing, but still very project oriented and with a real, what feels important is that there's a real tangible result at the end. And then I'm seeing it pop up in other like non-institutional spaces as well. Collectives like the Visionary Futures Collective, which has cropped up during COVID-19 to come together and voluntarily work to build projects that matter to people and that draw on academic resources. researchers during the Trump administration pulled together a map that showed some of the child separations that were happening in the ICE detention centers. And those kinds of non-institutional, quickly spun up collaborations that assess the landscape and find a need and really work to build something that satisfies it have been really inspiring to me. And it's been great to see.
That's a lot of examples. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Can you tell us a bit about the talk that you're going to give, which is called Scholarship for the Public Good, Expanding Definitions of Academic Success?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I came to Syracuse a few years ago and talked about career pathways and digital skills. And in the time since then, I've continued to think about the question of career pathways and public engagement, but where my thinking has really evolved has been in understanding the value structures that surround what makes something seem viable or desirable or not. I'll be talking about what those value systems look like and why it is often so difficult to, even when a program seems really well-designed, it has a great, you know, visionary set of ideas, it's funded, it has the human resources behind it to really try something new. And yet still, sometimes the deeper institutional change is hard to make happen. It might fade when a project lead moves to something different, or it just might not take hold in the way that an institution hopes. And I've come to think of those moments as something similar to what Sarah Ahmed describes in her book On Being Included as a brick wall. She's talking specifically about diversity initiatives. And I think it applies in other contexts as well, where there is a tension between the explicit articulated values of an institution. We want diversity. We want innovative work. We want public-facing work on one hand, and the unarticulated tacit values that actually are the foundation of so much of the structures at the institution. So even if they're saying these things on their website or in their mission statement or whatever, if tenure structures still support a more conservative model, or if admission structures still support a conservative model, you're only going to get so far. And so what I've been thinking about a lot is, how can we think differently, not only about the kinds of programming that we're putting in place or the curriculum, but about those underlying value structures? Because without really getting at that, I don't think that lasting change at a broad scale is particularly likely. So that's what I'll be talking about, what it might look like to think differently about how we value knowledge, what we understand as knowledge, how we, what are the systems that ascribe value to different types of work, and how can we maybe listen differently to scholars who are saying that they want to be doing different types of work, or to students who are looking for something new.
Thank you so much for that. That is, I think, a roadblock, a wall that people encounter, which is, yeah, I have this great idea. I want to do this particular thing, a non-monographic dissertation, for instance, and that's fine. And everybody really wants me to do it, but they also want me to write a dissertation. Yeah. And I have one life, and here mm-hmm. I am, and I want this to count, but people are worried about whether it is in fact, as rigorous as it should be. And if it is rigorous, how do we know? And what do we do with it? And mm-hmm. everybody knows that what we're all looking for is a CV that is heavy, that's mm-hmm. got a lot of entries in it about publications and of a very specific kind. Mm-hmm. And getting past that and validating other elements is challenging.
Yeah, and it can't be the most vulnerable people in the system who are constantly the ones trying to push the boundaries, you know? I mean, often it's grad students who want to be pushing those boundaries, but they also need to finish their degrees and they need to get done. And, you know, they're working within a very rigid system often, with really, you know, material as well as intellectual and procedural constraints. And it shouldn't be on them to try and push the whole apparatus, you know? So I think there's a lot of push and pull.
Especially when you're talking about in the humanities, where direct relationships between what you write, for instance, and what kind of funding you get are, you know, without that kind of relationship, which is much more prevalent in the sciences, it's much harder to focus on it, as you point out in the book, the role of impact versus the role of prestige. It's really a prestige economy, and prestige is often really at, maybe always at odds with impact in a certain sense.
And I think that this is also connected to a devaluation of teaching. I think that if we, we collectively as, you know, people in and around academia, if teaching were more deeply valued, not just as, you know, the work that needs to be done so that we have time for research, but as a craft, as an intellectual activity, as something that shows our expertise as scholars to be able to articulate it to a non-specialist audience. I think that if we valued that more, it would feel like less of a leap to see the value, the research value and the intellectual value in, you know, an op-ed, in a publication for, a, again, for a non-specialist audience. So I think that those two are connected. Teaching load, you know,
I think that's absolutely right. That's where impact is everything there.
Right.
If you're a teacher.
Right, right. But hard to measure.
Hard to measure people holding a piece of chalk and looking at a blackboard. So Katina, given your experience, you know, as a person who is doing this work and sees, I think, the fruits of pushing for public humanities scholarship and advocating for it, but also as a former grad student yourself, a former PhD student in Comp Lit, what advice do you have for people who are listening who are either thinking about getting a PhD or indeed in a program?
I think that I think it's really important to be self-aware about your own situation, your material needs, you know, to really be realistic about what you're hoping for and what makes a situation viable and sustainable for you. I mean, I think that it's not that common to talk about material realities and conditions in graduate education or in academia more broadly.
I'm not sure what could be more ironic, but you're right.
And that stuff really matters, you know, if
you got to get paid,
you have to get paid. You need to have health insurance. I mean, I think this is even more apparent right now during the pandemic, because there is just, you know, like what can people do? There's just not, there's not enough time. There's not enough resources. There's not enough support. And I think that being aware of, you know, what is being asked of you in a program, being willing to prioritize yourself and to say no when you need to, that's been something that I've seen to be really important in the pandemic among graduate students that I work with, being able to, you know, pull back a little bit and say, you know, I have to take care of my family right now, or whatever the case may be. But I think, you know, for someone who might be considering graduate school right now, it's a great moment to think about those questions, because if you have, you know, the possibility of choosing among different options, or if you're looking at grad school as one among several options, think about those material conditions now. What kind of support do they offer? Not only material support, but also, does it seem like there's a good community of students there who support one another and form peer groups on their own? That's usually a good sign of the health of a program if people, you know, collectively jump in and have one another's backs like that. Yes. What do the mentorship structures look like within the program? All of that stuff really matters. So I think that the earlier you can ask yourself those kinds of questions, both about material conditions and also about what you really want out of the degree, the better. But it's also never too late. So I think that even for people who are at a late stage of grad school, finding ways to think about, I don't love the term like translatable skills, but transferable skills. I think of them more as translational skills, that if you can think about the things that you're doing and use the research skills that you have to sort of dig in and imagine yourself in another space, think about how you would be using those in a different context and how they might matter. It doesn't have to be, you know, paid work. If there's community collectives that you're already a part of. Think about the work that you do in those spaces and think about how it affects your research too, because it's not, our research isn't happening in a vacuum. If you're a parent, how does your parenting affect the way you do your research? You know, all of these things are, I think the more we can make those connections across different spaces of our lives, the less of a jump it feels like to step into other professional spaces as well.
Thank you so much for that, Katina. I would add one thing that Lenny Casuto, whom I'm sure you know, said to me when I started my program at Fordham, mm-hmm. which I think is not true for all grad students, but is common in and maybe always true in the humanities, which is that you are the CEO of your program, of your doctorate. And mm-hmm. you don't go there to fulfill the wishes of your faculty members. You go mm-hmm. there to fulfill your needs. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is partly what you're saying here, right? Is mm-hmm. you come in with certain expectations and you have to work to make sure that those expectations are met or that mm-hmm. as things change, you're allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really hard to accomplish in academia, but also just so important. Mm-hmm. And I remember the day when I remembered that I could get a job and that I could be an adult human and and do something in the world. And mm-hmm. that was a really revolutionary day. And that's sad because it shouldn't have been a revolutionary day. It should have been a Tuesday.
Mm. Right.
And that's just such an important part of it. And I think I would echo mm-hmm. the importance of materiality. You know, we're mm-hmm. among a bunch of cultural materialists mm-hmm. who don't necessarily always think about the material conditions of those with whom they work. Yeah. And that's where there needs to be support and affirmation, but also where, and this is unfair, where grad students need to take that up for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, self-advocacy is really important. And not everybody is equally able to do that, but to the degree that you can, I think it, you know, nobody else is going to protect your boundaries for you. So the more you can do to make sure you have what you need, the better.
Katina, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been a great conversation. And I think very clearly the precursor to other great conversations that you'll have with us. So I hope that everybody listening will register for the talk that you'll give and also for the coffee hour. I'll just repeat it again. The talk is called Scholarship for the Public Good, Expanding Definitions of Academic Success. That will take place on Thursday, March 11th at 3 p.m. And there is a coffee hour also with Katina. And I guess you'll have to bring your own coffee these days. And that's on Friday, March 12th, 1 to 2:30. So thank you very much, Katina.
Thank you for having me. This is a great conversation.
And thanks to everybody listening. This has been Syracuse University GradCast.